Today at Reader's Corner, an encore edition with Essie Adugian, award-winning author of the novel Washington Black. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is novelist Essie Adugian, speaking with us about her book Washington Black. The novel won the prestigious Giller Prize and was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. The book follows the experience of a young slave in Barbados, George Washington Black, or Wash as he's known. Plucked from the plantation fields to serve in an unlikely position with the master's brother, an eccentric abolitionist and inventor, Wash's story is a thrilling historical narrative about the concepts of freedom, love, and heartbreak. Essie Adugian is the author of the novels The Second Life of Samuel Tyne and Half-Blood Blues, which won the Giller Prize and was a finalist for the Man Booker Prize, among many other awards. In 2014, she published her first book of nonfiction, Dreaming of Elsewhere, Observations on Home. Essie Adugian, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So when I first called you, you were getting your kids off to school. Do your kids understand they're the daughter of a famous novelist here? Do they appreciate your success?
You know, I don't think they quite understand it, and that's fine by me. You know, I'm just a mom. I'm just kind of whisking them off here and there and running after them and making sure they, you know, they do their homework and all of this. And it's, it doesn't seem to have had much of an impact on their sense of me.
Well, I'm sure it will as they get older. And again, your record to date is incredible with these novels, and Washington Black in particular. I so much enjoyed it. People often ask me, how do you find the books that you put on Reader's Corner and the authors you have a chance to interview? And my answer is always, I hang out in bookstores and read reviews. I don't even remember whether it was the review I read first or whether it was the book I found in the bookstore, but I got into it and didn't give it up until it was over. I was absolutely rooting for Wash all the way. This story is set in Barbados. Why Barbados? I, you know, was thinking, well, this is going to be the American South, because that's what we on the south side of the line, Canada, America, oftentimes think of.
Yeah. You know, it was something that came very organically out of my original source material, because I originally thought I was writing a book that was entirely different from what Washington Black ended up being. I thought I was doing a novel based on the Tichborne Claimant series of trials,
sure,
which was this very infamous cause célèbre at the time, but which most people have forgotten these days. And it was a whole series of criminal trials in the 1860s, going right into the 1890s, that centered around an imposter looking to claim a place amongst the aristocracy. And one of the main witnesses in that whole cycle of trials was an ex-slave called Andrew Bogle, who had been stolen off a plantation in the Caribbean by a member of the Tichborne household. And he was originally from Jamaica, but in telling his story, or a story like his, which I realized I didn't want to actually tell the Tichborne story, I was much more interested in a person who was like Bogle rather than Bogle himself. When I started digging into the history of slavery and how it manifested itself in the Caribbean, I found some really great source material that focused on Barbados, and it was very, very detailed on a granular level of sights and sounds, and that ended up being why I focused on Barbados. That's a very roundabout answer.
Well, I'm really struck by the title of the book, because I learned something in doing a little background work on your book. I come from Chicago originally, and during the time I lived there, one of the mayors was Harold Washington, an African-American who had been a member of the legislature. And in the legislature at that time, there were many African-Americans who had the names of famous people in American history. And I hadn't really thought about how that all happened. In fact, I suppose I probably would have guessed that it was a tribute that the slave owner might be paying to the slave. I learned otherwise. Tell us about the whole naming situation as far as slaves are concerned.
Yes, and in fact, that name Washington, when I was doing my own research into it, I think it was like the ninth most common name for African Americans. Mm-hmm. in the United States. I've decided to use that name, or it came to me because I'd been reading very deeply into this process of naming, you know, how they went about naming slaves in Barbados. And, you know, some of these names were quite, quite strange. And you really began to feel as though they were almost like a psychological warfare used against the slaves. They were full of mockery, a lot of them. I remember names like Ruddy Christmas and Thieving Mary and these kinds of names, but also names, you know, like Cicero and Caesar and, you know, George Washington,
right,
and, you know, Thomas Jefferson. And you really get the sense that these were a way of, you know, to take a slave who has, I guess, would have been regarded as something less than a man, and would have had no sense of his life as something full of meaning or worthy of investigation or worthy of meaning, and to take him and to give him a name like George Washington. This is really like saying, you will never amount to anything like George Washington. And isn't this something funny and a great irony that you've been bestowed with this name?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what I was trying to get at by giving him this name, but also the sense that this is a name that he recognizes was born out of that kind of an impulse. And so what he's trying to do throughout the novel is to reshape that name and reclaim it and find ways of existing within the confines of that name and to make it his own. And so he shortens it to Wash, and, you know, there's all of these ways of, at some point he tries to go by George, and that doesn't feel quite right. And it's really him trying to renegotiate his identity by adjusting his name.
And the bottom line is that so many of these slave owners were not really paying tribute to these national heroes or whatever you want to call them, but in a sense,
no,
mocking the slave.
Mocking the slave, yeah. Exactly.
Well, let's talk about how your own personal experience leads to a novel like this. You grew up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Your parents emigrated from Ghana. To what extent does that inform your work? To what extent is that the reason why you might have written this book, because you wanted to tell a story?
You know, I think if it informs my work, it's very indirectly. It was almost something that had to be pointed out to me, because it wasn't something that I was certainly setting out to make my project.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of writing about people who are on the sidelines of history. You know, if we read historical texts, they're not necessarily the people who are at the center. You know, they're the supporting cast. They're the outcasts. And taking these people who have been, you know, so little seen, and making them the main characters and centering them. And I think maybe perhaps that does come a little bit out of my being, you know, growing up in the 80s in Calgary, Alberta, which wasn't maybe the most diverse diverse place
imagine.
To be at the time. Yeah, and very much feeling as though it's this strange dichotomy of feeling like very marginalized and very sidelined, but also feeling very visible at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And attracting an attention that's not always positive, but definitely standing out. And I think all of my characters through all of my novels have had this duality of being not central to the larger narrative, but being very visible and standing out and attracting this kind of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that that's probably something that's at play in Washington Black, for sure. But at the same time, it's not a deliberate choice.
Sure.
To kind of speak that part of my reality. It hasn't been something that I've set out to do.
The earlier parts of your novel really underscore the brutality of slavery in giving specific examples of things done to slaves. The one that I can't forget is the one where they pour honey over the slave and then let the flies basically kill him. You did significant research on this book. And first of all, I'd be curious, where do you go to get the research that shows things like that actually happened? Did you go to Barbados, or is there some other place where you find this information? Obviously, it's based on historical record.
Yeah, I got it from books, really.
Uh-huh.
It's books. I mean, there are some sites you can go to on the internet that can actually look at historical documents that people have uploaded, but it's mainly just reading widely. And that particular punishment, I recall, came from a memoir that I read that a woman had written about her family's legacy of slavery in Barbados. So she kind of tracks her great-great-great-great-grandfather's first establishment of his, you know, he's actually breaking the ground to create his plantation on Barbados. And that was, I think the memoir is called Sugar in the Blood by Andrea Stewart, I believe. And that was something that had come out of that as being a description of one of the many horrors that was perpetrated on the slaves. And you just, I mean, when you're reading some of this stuff, you just can't believe, you know, the lengths that people went to, sort of dark, disgusting creativity right. and energy that they put into these punishments. But there it is.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Essie Adujan, author of the new novel Washington Black. When I talk to people about your book and why they should read it, that's what I always say is that, you know, you can read history, but it doesn't give you any idea of the personal experience that someone might have moving through a certain period of time, in this case, a slave in Barbados or the American South, wherever it is, and you've done that so magnificently. Now, we have a policy here at Reader's Corner. We never give away the plot. we don't want to ruin it for the reader who's going to pick your book up next week. So I'm only going to talk about what is on the back side of the paperback edition I have, and we'll leave the rest to the reader. So why don't you begin by filling us in on George Washington Black's life? Maybe a little bit about Titch, since he's so central to this story. And as I said, you can go as far as you can go without giving away anything other than what the reader can pick up on the back of the book.
Sure. So I tend to talk about the novel, you know, I call it a post-slavery narrative. And I say this because for me, the novel is really about this young slave boy who's christened George Washington Black. He's 11 or 12. He's not quite certain, but he has a general idea of when he was born. And it's really about him trying to make his way in the world after he's achieved some measure of freedom and, you know, what that freedom should look like for him. And also trying to negotiate a space for himself in the world where his gifts will be recognized. But I'll begin at the outset of the novel just to give a sense of movement. So at the outset, George he's a field slave. He has known no other life but that of a field slave. You know, it's been a very brief life of savagery and brutality. And so he's really shocked to one day discover himself being taken to live in the quarters of his new master's brother, who's a man called Christopher Wilde, or nicknamed Titch. And he just assumes that this will be the end of him, that he's going to be, you know, at the very least, he'll be raped. At the very worst, he'll be killed. And so he's terrified. But it's this shocking thing when he discovers that Titch is so different from every white man that he's ever known. And Titch he's a gentleman scientist. So he's an inventor. He's an illustrator, he's a naturalist, he's a bit of a chemist, he does all of these things, but he's also an abolitionist, at least in name. And it's through his removing Wash from the fields and teaching him to read and teaching him to draw that Wash starts to feel his first stirrings of personhood and a sense of himself. And the two end up having to leave the plantation after a very terrible event happens, and it's about them going out into the world together, but then Washington really having to establish himself and gain his own footing and really to gain a sense of himself as a fully realized human being, which is something that he, you know, has been utterly crushed out of him until he's forced to make his way out into the world. So the book is about him finding a way to live within his own sense of freedom and redefining that freedom, But it's also a book about early science, so Enlightenment science, and it's a love story, and it's a book about, I guess, in some kind of very complicated way, it's a book about mm-hmm. male friendship and about father figures and all of these things.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he's freed, in quotes, in the 19th century when, you might say, Wash is entering a world that really doesn't have a place for him. He's going to have to carve this out for himself. I guess it's hard for us to understand today what that would be like, but it's not like being a free man today. It's a time when so many people didn't think people of color should be free.
Exactly. And his freedom is very contentious because of the way that he, I mean, it's sort of claimed for him. It's not something that, you know, this is not sort of post-emancipation. Like, it's still in the death throes of slavery. So he's nervous out in the world. He's constantly looking over his shoulder. And then once emancipation actually does happen, he still has that sense of nervousness, of being, you know, the sense that he will always be pursued. But also, as somebody who's very gifted and talented, I mean, he ends up being a great artist and a scientist, actually. He recognizes that there are limits to what others will grant him. You know, there are limits to how free he will be able to be, like how he can, you know, how much others will allow him to exercise his gifts and to show what he knows, and because these gifts won't be acknowledged by others, given his skin color and his past. And that's a very sad thing, you know, to look at him and to understand that were he born in another era, this is somebody whose life would have been a very full one, you know, and something where he would perhaps have been celebrated. But given the circumstances of his birth, you know, there are real limits to what he will be allowed to achieve.
I'm looking at the paperback edition of Washington Black, and it has a beautiful and elaborate illustration of a hot air balloon. And I'm curious, first of all, how you found the hot air balloon to insert into the novel. And then secondly, if you could comment on Wash and his selection by Titch to become this free slave. In a sense, he was needed. I mean, Titch was experimenting with this hot air balloon, and if nothing else, I guess you could say he needed dead weight. But you can explain
yeah.
that.
Yeah, so when Wash is initially selected by Titch to come and aid in his experiments, you know, and carry his instruments, essentially to come and live with him and work as his assistant, the main reason that he initially selects him is because he's been working on an invention that he calls the cloud cutter, which is like a very early model of a hot air balloon, essentially. And he needs a second person to help man the controls, but he also needs that weight for ballast. And he sees Wash and he thinks he's a pretty good size for this. And, you know, hopefully he'll be smart enough that I can teach him to man these controls, because it's a very basic thing. And so, you know, he's really astonished. Titch becomes very astonished to learn that Wash actually, you know, is a very intelligent boy and has all of these gifts. And it's this moment for him where he's very surprised. And Wash, as a child, thinks there's something kind of odd about that, but he doesn't, you know, he doesn't really have the wisdom or the experience to see that the wrongness of that. And it's only retrospectively when he's older where he looks back and he thinks, you know, that moment where he saw that I actually had some intelligence, like that was, you know, that shouldn't have been a surprise to him. And maybe he's not, you know, he wasn't as open-minded and as sort of liberal as he thought that he was.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Essie Adugin, author of the new novel Washington Black. The book follows the experience of a young slave in 1830s Barbados as he struggles to win his freedom and define himself. You have a beautiful quote. You have many beautiful quotes in this book, but I want to read one, and I won't comment on where this is in the book or anything like that, but the last sentence of this book, I think I would enjoy your comment. This is basically Wash talking to Titch. "You took me on because I was helpful in your political cause, because I could aid in your experiments. Beyond that, I was of no use to you, and so you abandoned me. I was nothing to you. You never saw me as equal. You were more concerned that slavery should be a moral stain upon white men than by the actual damage it wreaks on black men." I thought that last sentence really sums up what you're trying to say here, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And as I was reading about the abolitionist cause in England, that was something that struck me about some of the people involved, the fact that there did seem to be this dimension of white morality that was privileged over the actual experiences of black people who were undergoing this horrible system, or who were trapped in this system. There was a sense that if we continue this, that we will be jeopardizing our entrance into heaven, because, you know, ostensibly all God's creatures are created equally. But, you know, there wasn't really that sense of black men as being the equals of white men. And so this was very fascinating to me as I was doing some research. And I think I've mentioned this in other interviews, but I was very struck by this almost like a throwaway paragraph in one of the books I was reading, in which a Quaker meeting was described by an observer. And so it was all of these, you know, men sitting in the House of Friends talking about, this was in New York, I can't remember the year, but they were discussing, you know, the plight of the black man and what could be done to bring about the end of slavery. And there were three black people in attendance who were runaway slaves, but they were meant to sit on pews which were separate and away from, you know, the Quakers, and they weren't at all consulted for their opinions, or to, you know, mm-hmm. to shed some light on things and give their perspective. And I was really taken by that. I just thought that was, you know, just this ridiculously ironic thing. And you know, that wasn't kind of an isolated thing that I'd read about it. And yeah, there were some people who were sort of operating with this idea of wanting to really, I guess, erase the shame.
Right.
And that was what was first and foremost for them.
Yeah, it was more about whether they were going to get into heaven or not. So let's talk for a moment about Wash's relationship to Tana. And it seems like one of the things you seem to be pointing out here is that there are certain limits to a freed slave's options in this period, and his struggles with how to express himself and how to engage in a relationship. His relationship with Tana is all about that. Could you tell our listeners a little something about that aspect of the novel?
Yeah, I guess she's somebody who is, I hesitate to say love interest, because that diminishes her somewhat. And she's, mm-hmm. I mean, she's this very intelligent, extremely feisty, attractive woman. She is biracial. So she's the daughter of an Englishman who's also a naturalist. So this is how he sort of comes to know Wash, is through this interest that they share. And a woman from, you know, a South Sea Islander who has passed away. But she was essentially raised in England. But it's this contentious thing when they get together, because she's so much lighter skinned than him and could, I guess, potentially pass for a white woman in certain circumstances. And so it's really this fraught thing, you know, when they're together in certain places, because this is something where her very appearance creates danger for him. But, I mean, they're so like-minded and they're so beautifully suited to each other. It almost becomes another miracle that they mm-hmm. were able to find each other. But her brilliance is also something that's been overlooked as well. As a young woman who has always taken part in her father's experiments and helped him with his work, you know, because she's a young woman, she will never get the credit for that. And her father really, he appreciates her, but, you know, she's still just a girl. She's still just his daughter. And so, you know, he doesn't respect her on the level that you feel that he might do if she was a son. Mm-hmm. So Tana and Wash share that kind of the sense of their lives as being lived on the margins. This is something that they very much have in common, that they sit outside of things, and this is what brings them together.
Your novel is quite the adventure. There's an escape in a hot air balloon, there's a bounty, there's travel to exotic locales, there's forbidden love. Was it your intention, I'm asking this question for aspiring writers out there, was it your intention to lay out an outline of how this was all going to work out, or do you let your characters take you there?
You know, I always start every book with this elaborate outline that I, you know, spend weeks working on this beautifully realized outline and just think this is great. And then after about a week, I've completely deviated from it. It's like gone in a totally different direction. The characters are different. Everything is different. And, you know, I realize I'm never going to get back to anything in the outline. But I think it's part of the process to start by telling yourself, I know exactly where I'm going. And I know everything right up until the ending, because this is just, you kind of need that psychologically, this idea that you have a map. But I think part of what's so pleasurable about writing is that it's play as well. And so you deviate from this map and you don't kick yourself about it. Because I think if you were to stick to the map, you'd have a very schematic and dry and kind of unnatural feeling book. Like, a book wants to be what it wants to be, and it needs to be able to dance around and to go in different places that you didn't expect, and that's also what keeps the writer interested, I think, mm-hmm. as well as the sense of possibility that anything could happen that day when you sit down at your desk, and that's an exciting thing.
Right. I have so much admiration for your style of prose. I mean, it's so accomplished and talented. And every now and then, I don't oftentimes get this opportunity, but I get the chance to ask what I guess is the last question of our interview today. You know, where does this come from? Let's call this a multiple choice. A, it's a teacher who made the difference when you were a kid in school. B, it's a young student like yourself who read everything you could get your hands on, regardless of what your parents or your teachers said. Third, it was a family of writers or parents who just encouraged you to write and read. It was either none of the above or all of the above. So you've got a lot of choices there.
Yeah, I would say, I guess, all of the above. All of the above. But I would add very specifically that when I first realized that you could study writing as something at university, which blew my mind, and you could go and get a degree in writing. One of the things I did, I thought I was going to study journalism and ended up being swayed over to the poetry department because of some very charismatic teachers there. So I studied with my first poetry teacher was a poet called Patrick Lane, who's like a national treasure here. And he just passed away this year. But what a writer, like what a poet. And I just feel like being in his workshop and being exposed to all different kinds of poetry and how poetry is put together, like, this is huge for me. And poetry is, you know, I'm still extremely devoted to reading poetry. And I think that this is where the prose style comes out of, is from reading poets who tend to look at every single word that they put on the page and weight it. And, you know, if that single word, even if it's like the word ah or the, you know, if it's not doing its work, then they cast it out. And I think that's something that I try to do in my prose, is to look at every single word and make sure that it needs to be there.
Well, Patrick Lane's poetry clearly found its way into your prose, and I'm going to send this interview over to our MFA in Creative Writing program so those poets over there can hear what you just said. They will be absolutely delighted, Essie. But in the meantime, we've run out of time, but I just want to say again to our listeners, first of all, pick up a copy of Washington Black by Essie Adugin. And secondly, Essie Adugin, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. We look forward to your next novel.
No, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.